Good morning again and welcome as we continue our conversation on the book of Ruth this morning. And my name is David Vasquez. I'm one of the campus pastors at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And we've had just a lot of fun this week and also some really deep conversation about a text that is dear to many of us. If you're joining us today for the first time, welcome to both the village. If you are new to the village today or for the first time back, first day back, glad that you can join us this morning. We will offer a short prayer as we begin. We'll do a little bit of looking back to the text that we have been talking about, kind of catch each other up on what we've been talking the last couple of days, and then kind of make our way through the text. The approach we're taking is primarily just reading the text a little bit at a time, hearing it in parts as a story that is very lively and very well crafted. So we're reading sections of it and then sort of stopping and thinking about what it is that we hear. And what's enriched our conversations the most has been the fact that people have been willing to jump in and share either things that you have heard in this text before, from when you've studied it before, or is something that strikes you as for the first time now, either because you're only reading it for the first time or just had not noticed something. So we invite you to be willing and ready to do that, to kind of contribute to enrich our conversation together. The second thing that we've been trying to kind of keep in mind among the many voices that we bring or the many experiences that we bring to reading this text, one that we have been intentional about keeping in mind is that this is a story of migration in the way that many biblical stories are stories of people on the move, that they take place when people are in a time of transition. In our own lives, and certainly in our sacred texts, we see that people are often very, perhaps more open to the divine at times of transition, and so those are the stories we often have retained. Many of our biblical stories reflect those moments of transition in people's lives. And so we have brought that awareness to it, and part of what, in my own experience, has helped me to be aware of that part of the story, or that lens for the story, has been reading that texts like Ruth and other texts with people who live on the move and who are very aware of their migration experience, much more so than many of us are, in part because they live in this country as undocumented immigrants. And so that means that their reality of migration and mobility is something they live with every day. So that's one of the lenses that, I just named that one out because some of the other ones we perhaps are more familiar with using those voices when we come to the text. But that's one that has helped inform my own understanding of this text. So we'll start out with prayer and then begin our time together.
Restore and renew us, O Lord. May those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. Those who go out weeping come home with shouts of joy. Amen.
Thank you. So let's catch up a little bit. The story we are looking at is the story of Naomi and Ruth. I've often referred to this as the story of two migrations. The first one is that Naomi, with her family, are forced because of famine, or choose because of famine, depending on how you read the story, to leave because of the lack of food in the land, a major famine, but also because of the collapse of the political system. And so they go, of all places, to enemy territory, to the country of Moab. And there's long history behind that we explored a bit on our first day together. When they get to Moab, they integrate into that community. Her sons marry, but then something happens. We're not told the conditions of this, but both her husband and both of her children die when they are in Moab. And then when she is then left bereft, she decides to go back. She hears, even in Moab, that hears the good news of God and hears that God has been merciful to God's people in Bethlehem. Ironically, the house of bread was without bread, but now God has blessed them, and so they begin their journey of return. We've heard today about return to the Lord, return, and that is certainly a major theme in the biblical story. And so she returns, heads back, initially with both of her daughters-in-law, beginning that journey back, where now all three of them widows, and because of the world they live in, a place where they are perceived as people with very little resources, very little future, very little options. And then one of her daughters-in-law stays, the other one, Ruth, chooses to go with her and expresses an oath of a commitment to her to go where she goes, that her God will be her God, that Naomi's people will be Ruth's people. And then the question is how she will be received. And we compare that experience of return to, as Naomi comes back, bereft, she says, I was full, now I've come back empty. And then yesterday we started to explore a little bit more about how they tried to find their way as people with very few resources, with very few options in the land they returned to in Bethlehem. So what are some things from our conversation yesterday that we should keep in mind as we return, or you want to kind of have stayed with you from yesterday?
Back to this corner yesterday, we were talking about how the other women might have perceived Ruth as she was gleaning as a foreigner, and then a favorite foreigner among the locals in the field. And I thought of all the ways that we insist that immigrants conform to our rules, to look to even and most especially to our sort of unwritten rules, and how we end up being offended if they don't, you know, that they're standing out, they're not doing things right like we do, even though those are cultural norms and not moral norms.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, the foreigners stand out, and so they may be judged a little bit more harshly than others in the community, you know. And the hard thing is that you may be judged both for assimilating, you know, in this case, Ruth might, because of she's being given preference. Somebody had made a comparison to, you know, company, and somebody comes in and it just kind of gets to the top right away. Somebody else countered that saying, well, but, you know, there's a relationship. So maybe it's nepotism and not necessarily preference for the foreigner, because she has some claim to the relationship with Boaz. But regardless of that, so sometimes people who are foreigners might find themselves very much standing out and so judged more harshly, perhaps, or at least the light's a little more brighter on them, at least they might feel that way, and either judge because they're assimilating too much, trying to kind of sneaking into power if they're succeeding, or on the other hand, the assumption that they don't fit in, that their, you know, culture and morals are different. Mm-hmm.
And to come back to the post-bill movie again and again and again, it's not just the immigrants who were working in that packing plant, it's also the people who ran the packing plant. They came, here you got these, quote, New York Jews with their beards, their black hats, and Hasidim coming into the small Midwestern community. That kind of is also a little bit of a, a little bit of what they kind of may have been perceived of immigrants as not quite belonging here.
Yeah, and that's and the film that and Jesse's referring to is one that some many of you were able to watch on Monday night about a large immigration raid in a small town called Postville, right in the northeast corner of Iowa, and a place that is very multicultural, where there has definitely been the question of who's the foreigner and who's the insider and the outsider. It really has dominated that community because of the diversity that has come to that place, and something that is beginning to happen across the country. So part of the conversation about immigration is important, not only because it helps enlighten us a little bit about the stakes, but also because it is an important contemporary issue that's affecting not only large cities, but actually, in fact, now over half of immigrants coming to the United States are going directly to rural areas. You know, if you look at I-35, those of you who may be familiar, a lot of folks here from the Midwest, so if you think about I-35, starts out in the south and comes straight through the middle of the country. If you take that corridor and you go out about 200 miles each way, about a third of all immigrants coming to the United States are in that swath of land. Because of the meatpacking plants, because of the corn production, because of milking, all of these things are in that area, and it all gets distributed through I-35. And so that's, you know, there are certain channels that, you know, part of what we emphasize so many is people follow trade. And so the trade follows that line in the middle of the nation.
In the past, they would have mainly come to California and eventually up here to Washington because of all the big agricultural.
Exactly. And that's another big, still a fairly significant, you know, travel on the East Coast, I mean, the West Coast of the country, and other paths happen. But that's one that hasn't necessarily been the case before. And so this issue of migration is not, or this conversation about immigration is not only about what's happening in the border or on the coast, but, you know, it's significant for all of our countries. Other things from the text from yesterday, and then we'll...
Well, I wasn't here yesterday, but after the day before that, I have a Lao brother who our family hosted when I was in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And then after the Vietnam War, my Polk sponsored him, got him out of a refugee camp in Thailand. So he's lived here now. We've been family to them for, 45 some years. And we just recently had a conversation, and it was just very poignant to hear Kim say that he still feels ever the immigrant. And partly, I think, because he, about 10 years ago, he went back to Laos to see if there's any prospect of going back. But he works for the state in immigration, but because he has that state, you know, kind of connection, there's a danger for him to go back. So I think that when that door closed, you know, him sharing just 2 weeks ago how he just still feels like he's very much the immigrant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It just touched me in a significant way. Yeah.
It's a part of the identity, and that's part of what we talked about yesterday. Ruth becomes very successful, but at a high price. You know, will the way she became successful kind of carry her whole life, you know, mark her in a way, her whole life, being a foreigner. Will she truly be fully accepted ever, you know, or will she even feel fully accepted even if she is? Is someone else over here?
I was just going to say, I have a daughter, my daughter is Greek, and my son-in-law is Romanian, and it's interesting. Sarah's been here since she was 11 months old, and she's very much treated as the immigrant. And Radish, who's been here since he was, for the last 5 years, because he's Caucasian looking, he's treated very much as the American. And so it's very interesting when they get together with a variety of people. He has a very thick accent. She has no accent at all. And so people spend a lot of time trying to figure out, well, how this all works and where they all fit. You know? And it's very confusing to a lot of people. So.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because one of the themes of the book is the idea of being noticed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boaz notices Ruth for some reason. You know, was she attractive? And being noticed, you want to be noticed for the right things. She works very hard to be noticed because she's up from early morning till late at night. And is very dedicated. That's what she wants to be noticed for, but she clearly, you know, the issue of being noticed is something that, you know, we're identifying here. That's a significant topic for those who are in a new community, and that can happen if you move from New York to Washington and you have an accent. You know, the question is who has the accent, right? But if the majority has the same way, <right? laughs> like here in the world, try to
just recalling, I mean, the limited choices the women had, how their livelihood, Ruth and to some extent Naomi, depended on Ruth finding favor of a man. And there was a statement in there that struck me a little bit for Boaz, recognizing that Ruth could have gone after younger men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That she, you know, and then he sees this as an important commitment, as a proof of her loyalty, you know, to have gone to him, an older man, rather than to younger men. So lots of things go floating.
What do we know about Boaz, or at least the culture? That is to say, was he a single man? Was this his second, third, fourth wife?
Absolutely nothing is told. Likely, as somebody in power with a lot of wealth, you know, part of wealth was represented in more than one marriage, but we really don't know. They were not told.
Culturally, could they have had more than one wife?
At that point, it still would have, yeah. You know, when you think about most of the patriarchs, you know, Sarah and Hagar, you know, Abraham and children with both Hagar and Sarah, didn't recognize Hagar as a wife, it was a concubine, that was also common. Jacob, you know, has four wives, you know, two of whom are concubines. Solomon, the perfect example of lots of wives and lots of concubines. So King David, so that would have been a common. Of course, King David comes even later. So this would have been a period where it's likely, at least in the way that the story is set, you know, the time of the judges. So, right here.
What struck me was you brought up the power and strength of the women's cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the Bible.
Yeah. And that was, you know, and it's huge, the kind of risks, and for those of you who weren't able to be here yesterday, there's a huge amount of risk that Ruth takes in going to the threshing floor in the middle of the night, basically proposing to Boaz, and she's taking huge risks in this. And the only way that she's able to do this is because there is a huge high degree of trust between Naomi, who suggests this, and Ruth, who goes along with it to a certain extent. You know, but there's a high degree of trust between them to protect each other's back as they kind of venture into this together. Is that commitment that they made on the hill right outside of Moab as they were heading out, and she says, I'm sticking with you, they are now living that out. That was not just words, but now they're becoming a reality in the rest of the book. One last comment back here. Did you have a comment? Okay.
Can I make a couple of quick comments? I was listening to a lecturer himself as a refugee kicked out of Ghana when he was a child.
Who's that?
I was listening to a lecture, and the guy who was making the presentation himself was a refugee kicked out of Ghana during Idi Amin regimes. Lived in various camps, and now he lives here. One thing he said was the trauma of that displacement lasts for 3 generations. But want to remember something in the background. This is my second migration.
For yourself?
For myself. So we came here with some basic skills and education, and there's a family that sponsored us, and all that kind of background was there. Soon after we came to the country, we became members of Lutheran Church. God sent a lot of good people our way. So it was all good, but still there were issues. Okay. So both my girls went to college here, studied and all that, and my older daughter was in a very well-paid job with a software company. And one fine day she came home and told Mom and Dad, I'm going to quit the job. We asked, what are you going to do? And she said, I'm going to work for refugees. So that was, did she undergo a trauma when we came here? I don't know. But what she did was really good. She took a 50% pay cut. But something in her said, that's the righteous thing to do. She was very, very happy.
What should we be proud of?
Well, yeah, she brought a lot of stories of immigrants and utter abuse. Some of them went to torture. A 40-year-old woman would look at like a 60 or 70-year-old woman. So kind of rehabilitating them, giving them clothes, bring some pride in them. She's not a highly religious person. She went to Bible school for a couple of years. You know, just an average American kid. But what? How did she get the call? And for me to see the results of what she did, that's a great satisfaction. And that's one comment. The other one, I talked to you about yesterday, about Naomi telling Ruth, you know, cleanse yourself, put on ornaments and all that. It's a kind of a little thing that goes in India with brides. They prepare the bride. One time it was preparing the bride for the bridegroom. Now later on it has become pampering the bride. You know, they just put, you know, perfume and the sandalwood paste and, you know, a lot of fun stuff. Several changing the ornaments and the clothing and all that. Just has become a thing to pamper the
And I appreciate both of those things are very powerful, and I appreciate your openness to share your personal story as well and the power of that. A couple of things on that before we, you know, one is there's a researcher at the University of Western Washington that's working specifically on looking at the impact of migration and the severing of relationships, particularly for people who came in the 1800s from Northern European countries, where there was no possibility of returning, no way of staying in contact with family, and how that trauma, you know, she is tracking a lot of that trauma into, you know, 2-3 generations later, you know, how some of those things remain with us as well. So I appreciate your naming that for us. And it does raise a question, how does this story and the way that it's told, you know, invite us to think differently about someone like King David, who would have been the third generation from Ruth, at least in the way that the story is told, you know, that what of this experience remains a part of who King David becomes, you know. We certainly have currently a precedent who's one generation removed from that migration experience. How does that influence who who he is, how he functions, how we perceive him as well. So it's certainly a major issue about how we perceive him in terms of his origins, but you know, also in a very negative way. The second comment about brides, that's something that you know we can carry on as we think about the, we will go back to the reading the text. Many scholars have looked at this text and said, what's going on here? These women are enacting a wedding before anybody has said peep. You know, they are doing what was traditional to do at weddings. You first prepare the bride, the anointing, the language is very similar to the traditions of the wedding. And then we will see in here, is there a bride price being paid? You know, as we kind of go back to the text, what happens in the morning before she heads out after having spent the night with Boaz? there's several elements. The wailing that happened earlier, sometimes one of the part of the traditional wedding involves wailing, where the bride is in one family, and before she leaves her family, her whole family, particularly the women, do all this wailing as she leaves to go to the men's house. You know, well, there is a lot of wailing that happens in Orpah, who leaves Ruth and Naomi before they go. Her voice, you know, the description of that. So once you can kind of step back, look at the whole book and say, wait a minute, is there a wedding ceremony going on here that only the women know about? You know, remember that it is Ruth. It is Ruth who proposes. You know, this is, again, crossing many, many boundaries, you know. Wait, and he will tell you what to do. Well, she didn't quite wait until. All right, so let's go back to the text. And if you look at it, let's just kind of pick up a little bit on chapter 3. And we are going to go ahead and just read very briefly first through, beginning on verse 6. So if we can get a couple of readers, again, it can be some of the same folks from yesterday, but we need two narrators. This is one, second narrator somewhere. Two. All right, great. And then we need Ruth. Anybody want to be Ruth? Back here. All right. And Naomi. Anyway, let's see. Does Naomi have another part yet here? No. Yes, one more part. So Naomi. Back here. Great. And Boaz. Boaz. Maybe Boaz again. Okay. Stay with Boaz. All right, there we go. Okay, so let's just read through the end of, you know, from through the end of chapter 3, or through, yeah, through the end of chapter 3. So beginning with verse 6, we're just kind of going to read a little bit of a longer chunk. Some of it we read yesterday, but it'll provide us good background.
So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had instructed her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and he was in a contented mood, he went to lay down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came stealthily and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there, laying at his feet, was a woman. He said,
"Who are you?"
"I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin."
"May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. We have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. For all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman. But now, though it is true that I am a near kinsman, there is another kinsman more closely related than I. Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will act as next of kin to you, good, let him do it. If he is not willing to act as next of kin to you, then as the Lord lives, I will act as next of kin to you. Lie down until the morning."
So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before one person could recognize another, for he said,
"It must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor."
Then he said,
"Bring the cloak you are wearing and hold it out."
So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her back. Then he went into the city. She came to her mother-in-law, who said,
"I think this is supposed to be a Naomi."
Oh, Naomi, yes, 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 thank you. Mm-hmm.
"How did things go with you, my daughter?"
Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying,
"He gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed."
"Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but he will settle the matter today.
Cool. Anything that stands out to you? What kind of calls your attention in that portion? Any other parts we've read?
I noticed one thing, that even though Boaz says that he will do whatever she asks, but twice he suggests to her, stay here, you know, remain this night, he says. And later on he says, lie down until morning. So twice he's, even though he says he will do what she asks, but he's asking her to
do something. So there's a bit of a balance, and that's an interesting thing. You know, you have somebody who has as much power as it gets, against somebody who has no power, and yet there is a bit of a mutuality in this. They're telling each other what to do, right? Yeah.
And also, kind of says to her, get up and leave before anybody else knows you are here.
Mm.
You know, which kind of makes you wonder, what is he thinking of the situation?
He wants to protect her reputation.
Yeah.
He
okay.
doesn't want others to think that she was one of those women who comes to the threshing floor.
Yeah. Is that the only way to think of it?
Or he's a savvy politician.
What's that?
He's a savvy politician.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Protecting his own interests.
Protecting, I mean, and the thing is, it's both, right? They're tied now. Their interests are somewhat tied. They can be. Mm-hmm.
But also, if he ends up marrying her, he doesn't, well, people think that he's marrying a whore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if he has some interest in her, he's protecting her. In a way, he has less risk here, other than, you know, maybe some bad fame in marriage later. But he has a lot less risk than she does. I mean, it's okay for a rich man at the threshing hole having a party to have what he deserves, right? I mean, that's very, very crass. But culturally, that would not necessarily have been something that would have been certainly as much of a liability to her. Yesterday, someone contrasted the use of language about men and women. You know, you have, it's fairly common to point this out as a simple, you know, double standard around sexuality. You know, there are sluts and there are studs, you know, and they have carry very different meaning, whether you're a male or female.
I thought it was interesting how quickly Boaz already was ready to accept the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's already saying, you know, even though there's another kinsman, but in the morning, we'll figure this out. I mean, he's like ready to go forward.
Yeah, and it seems like Naomi believes that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
This guy's on. You know, this is going to happen quick. So why is that? What's the urgency for him? I mean, what might motivate him?
I'm curious, too, about the motivation with the next of kin.
Uh-huh.
Is he trying to get out of this, or is he just covering bases, or,
yeah,
you know, what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really tough night. And for Ruth, who may have been all excited about saying, you know, it takes a lot of courage for her to go through this whole rigmarole, show up at the threshing floor. We talked yesterday about all the risks she's taking. And then to dare to say to him, hey, you're the next of kin, you better do this. She's taking all this risk. And all of a sudden, things can really go wrong. And she realizes this. Oh my gosh, he is not the next of kin. So what if the next of kin does want to redeem her, and now she spent the night with someone else? I mean, this is really, it's a terrible night for her, you know? We read the story oftentimes knowing what happens in the end, and again, you know, it's got to be a happy ending, right? But that's not necessarily assured. We got to stay with the story.
Well, yeah, why is he so interested in moving forward quickly? Maybe she's bringing something to him that he doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. And that's a,
maybe he wants, they end up having children, maybe he doesn't have children.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's wealthy, as a lot of different women he could choose for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
He recognizes in her, that's a powerful thing to say, you know, he recognizes in her something he, for all of his wealth, for all of his well-being, that he is lacking or desires. You know, is it possible that it's love? I mean, well, what are the things happening here? In this story, we're not told, but certainly it's complicated. There's layers. Back up here and then down.
Is it possible it's just a good element in the story?
Sure, exactly. I mean, you know, you get cracked.
It brings it along. You know?
Yeah, kind of move it along, make sure that it happens. Yeah.
Well, he's at least, I'm guessing, 20 years older. I mean, he's been working on the threshing floor, smelly old dude, and she's all pretty, smelly, well, and, you know.
There's some serious sexual tension going on here, right? I mean, I did.
You wonder why he wants to move faster?
What's to explain, right?
I suspect, I mean, he recognized she was still, the role she was in was, she's at risk still, and I mean, he can only protect her so long with his words of telling the others to leave her alone and stuff, but maybe there's that urgency to get her out of that situation.
Exactly. And what's interesting is she spends the rest of the season still gleaning. I mean, you know, it's a little confusing because the next day he does go, but so there's a little bit of weirdness in the text because we're told, you know, that, oh, well, actually, we're not there yet, sorry. We'll get there. Where it says, you know, that she basically will spend the season still, you know, and I don't know how long the season for barley is now. Maybe. Could be a couple of weeks. Anybody know how long it takes?
I'm just struck and curious about the relationship between Boaz and Naomi and Naomi's original standing in the community. Mm-hmm. And how close akin they were, because it feels like there's a lot of trust between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like Naomi can predict how Boaz is going to
mm-hmm.
Respond, and Boaz is very solicitous of the mother-in-law of Naomi and wanting to make sure she gets fed as well. He sends food to her through Ruth. It makes me assume that there was some bond between them. And some sense of mutual regard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that, you know, I know we don't know much because they never encounter each other. There's no direct encounter, but those are significant things, that there are other bonds that may be driving some of this for them as well. And an interesting piece in terms of what's given, you know, there in the morning, he gives her 6 measures of barley. No idea how much that is, but evidently significant enough to be nine. So it's quite a bit of barley, but enough that she can carry it with her. And so there's lots of ways of interpreting that. Payment for services rendered, I mean, in the most crass way. And that's it. Will it end there? You know, he has no reason to fulfill his word. Or is it a bride price being sent to the mother-in-law? Now, that's quite radical, because this is an arrangement usually between males. And so is he kind of like, you know, going into what these women have taken into their hands to do in planning a wedding, you know? There's in the Megillah, which is a set, you know, the other day you had mentioned the fact that, Jesse had mentioned the fact that the book of Ruth is in a different placement in the Jewish order of books in the Tanakh than it is in the Christian use of the Old Testament. In the Christian Old Testament, it follows historically placed between between Judges, you know, following Judges. In the Tanakh, it is part of the Megillah, or the Megillot, which is a group of
five
books that are read at festivals, as you have mentioned.
Either at festivals or at days, or at other holy days, like Lamentations is read on the fast, which is kind of factually coming up on us, of Tisha B'Av, which is commemorates the destruction, supposedly, of both temples, the beginning of the Spanish Inquisition, anything, a whole bunch of other sad things that happened to the Jewish people, including possibly, from what I understand, the finding of the decision by the 12 spies to give a bad report,
mm-hmm.
and the people believing that, and God saying, mm-hmm. okay, you're going to wander 40 more years.
Yeah. And so in one of the commentaries around, so there's the five, you know, in that role, this is a text that is read then within the community repeatedly, and the Book of Ruth is read in the Festival of Weeks, or the Festival of the Harvest,
Shavuot, or Shavuot, mm-hmm. as it's called in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
And that does celebrate both the beginning, the end of the harvest festival for barley, which ended at that about that time. That's why. That's mm-hmm. where the connection is.
Mm-hmm.
It also celebrates the giving of Torah on Sinai. That's become a later thing,
mm-hmm.
once, especially after Jews stopped being so agricultural. Of course, early Zionists introduce the agricultural element again.
Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, and part of the significance of the placement of the book there as well is the fact that in that story, another interpretation of the six measures is a little bit more, you know, I'm not sure what term to use, but basically, you know, there are six worthy men that become descendants of Ruth. You know, when we get to, at the end, there is a genealogy given, and so one of the interpretations within that perspective is a little bit of saying, you know, is this being used as a way to sort of foretell or to celebrate or signify, you know, what would come of their union. So in a way, also a recognition that there are plans here for marriage, that he will follow up on that. So not just taking care of her for the day, but making a down payment on saying, yes, I accept your proposal, we will be married. No. So anything else that stands out to you in the text before we read the next section?
David?
Uh-huh.
You're doing a great job of painting the intensity of the risk for Ruth. But it seems to me that one of the things we get from refugee stories is an appreciation for this place in life where there is nothing but risk. Mm. No matter what she does, it's fraught with risk.
Yeah.
No. And some of that tension between being on that edge and being settled is that we can make risk more of an option.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll take a risk, maybe I won't. But in this spot, she's got no choice.
Very little to lose, yeah.
There were some refugees in one of the congregations we served, and they got here, and the first job they were offered was as upholsterers. They had never sewn, they had never upholstered, and they said, we'll figure it out.
We'll go with it.
They took the job, and...
Yeah. And yesterday we talked significantly about this fact. How do we measure right and wrong when the choices are so limited? If somebody's really, let's do this briefly here. Somebody, I need someone to read this little section here from Martin Luther King Jr. And it's just this indented section right here. Just a few words before you do that. One of the things we live with is the fact that, you know, we are reading back on a story told, right? We don't know what the decision making looked like at the time. Oftentimes, when you think about moments of revolutionary transition, the 1960s, the civil rights movement, or emancipation, or the movement for, to end slavery, a lot of the things we heard yesterday very eloquently in our proclamations, many of these things look very differently in retrospect. As we're going through them, the risks and the uncertainty is there. So the line I want you to keep in mind as we listen to Martin Luther King, a quote from him, is where what Naomi says is really quite interesting because it marks a change in the rhetoric and in the making up of the text as we move into chapter 4. Wait, my daughter. Now, the book begins with the action in the women. There's kind of like a very brief introduction about the famine and the movement, and the men are gone. And now this is the women's show. They have to carry the ball. And they figure it all out. They set it all up, and then they hit a wall as to what they can do. Now all Ruth can do is wait, my daughter. We will see what happens. They've done what they can within the choices they have. Some of it dubious, right around the edges, uncomfortable. All these things have happened. And now what they have to do is wait to see what happens. Keep that in mind when we go into the next chapter, because the voice of the women disappears as we go into the next chapter. And that's, you know, hugely significant. So,
on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because the conscience tells him it is right.
Prophetic words. Any reactions to that quote?
What does that have a lot of relevance in today's political partisan environment, doesn't it?
In what ways?
Well, I mean, I just despair sometimes to think that so few decisions seem to be made or even be possible based on what is right as opposed to what is popular. What is political? What will get you reelected? What will get your sponsors, your owners, your handlers happy? Mm-hmm. There just seems to be no discussion these days in the political arena about what is right.
So we have this woman who has very few choices, taking huge risks and doing what she knows to be right, even if it's around the edges of the law. But she does it out of courage, and yet we have very powerful, at least at this point, I think we're somewhere around 86% male in Congress, and only about 14% female. So I'll generalize. We have very powerful men and a few women that feel that they have no power, and that nothing can be done. At least it should be a very prophetic voice. This book is, I think, like it was in its original context, very prophetic in challenging us to say, you know, what are the questions? What guides our decisions? Other things.
It seems to me that Ruth and Naomi connived to approach Boaz. They knew it wasn't safe. They knew it wasn't politic. They knew it wasn't right. It wasn't popular. Boaz knew all of that too, but it certainly was very practical.
It was something that they felt was practical, but also right at that moment for them. This is what they needed in order to survive. Like you were mentioning, Paul, there was very few choices here for them, and risk was everywhere. They have no choice in terms of risk. You know, they're desolate. They have nothing. The harvest, they can glean during the harvest, but you can't glean enough to live all year round. You know, this is going to be a limited ability. They have pressure. We are told that Boaz has his reasons to be in a rush, but they certainly have a lot more pressure for this to be resolved quickly. And yet, Ruth is told, wait, we'll see how this turns out. It's just a really hard part of the story.
The circumstances can gray that line between right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a struggle. And yeah, you really have to search your conscience for, is this right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the nugget that I think we can spend a significant amount of time. One of the studies that I had written, Exodus, the beginning part of the book of Exodus, and a lot of the emphasis of that study around immigration is on what is right, because a huge argument about the changes in immigration or resistance to changes in immigration, or even to have any kind of empathy for 10 to 12 million people who live in the margins of our society as undocumented immigrants is, well, they broke the law. What part of illegal don't you understand? You know, as if laws are just God-given rather than human-made, the ones we're dealing with. And yes, we are a nation of laws. But how is it that our circumstances, if we happen to be middle class, have some access to power and benefit from the law, how do we hear the law, perhaps, you know, in a different way, or experience it as protective, while others may not?
Or how your interpretation of the law changes as your circumstances change. Mm-hmm. If you, I have a friend who is extremely law-oriented and took the position of they're breaking the law, they need to be out of here, that's it, until an undocumented person became very close to her family, and she got to see a whole different point of view. Well, then the laws should just be changed, and, you know. And so it's very easy to say this is the way and this is the right way, unless it affects you. Or families who have gay children suddenly, frequently, can change their mind about people who are gay, if compared to perhaps if they didn't know someone in their family.
Certainly, and I mean, and there's much in that, in you know. And particularly within Christianity, is an incarnational faith, right? So we're saying God finally became human so that we would get it. Like, I mean, at least that was the attempt. Ended up on a cross, but that was the attempt. In this story, out of the Hebrew Scriptures, we are embodying one individual, the particular, which is what we talked about in the very first day. The particular is trying to challenge this universal perception about immigrants. This is an immigrant who knows the law, who is faithful. And interestingly enough, in terms of the text, notice in verse 12 that what Boaz says about her is, you are a worthy woman. All my people know this. Really? Do all the people know this in the land there? Did everybody think this way about Ruth? But whatever the exaggeration is, he says, everybody ought to think great of you because you've been up all night. How faithful you have been to Naomi from the time that her husband died, and your husband died, and you had no reason to do this. She counters the stereotype of the immigrant that is perceived as whatever, lazy, not knowing the rules, not following them, not being willing to play their role, whatever it is. The individual breaks the
law. Laughing at us behind their back, our backs. And
exactly.
Thinking, which is, of course, one way of countering oppressive behavior.
Yeah.
Humor.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of play with it. Now, one final thing here, or two things in language that are just fun to point out and significant to keep in mind. One is, again, he's saying you're a worthy woman. That word, worthy, ha'il, in Hebrew, is actually the word that is used to introduce Boaz at the beginning. He was a worthy man. Now, this means somebody was standing upright, all of the good things. What's so powerful about him naming her a woman of worth, a woman of ha'il, is that he has inherited worthiness by gender, by inheritance of wealth and power, by his position. He may have lived up to it, but he has inherited most of this, and he's a person of status in his society. Again, named after one of the pillars of the temple. Or a temple pillar gets named after him after, whatever. And now he is naming this woman who is as opposite. She has no social status as a widow. She's a woman. She is a foreigner. And he says, you are worthy. And everybody knows it. You are worthy to be praised, is a phrase that we often use in our liturgy. Worthy is the Lamb. And think about the power of that phrasing, of naming this woman who would be the lowliest in the society as one that is worthy. And the power we have with our words, with our actions, to recognize in the actions of others their worthiness. Is that the way we view those in our society who live on the margins, who sometimes have to work their way around the law to fulfill the law? Do we call them worthy? Is that the way we perceive them? Not that all of them, we could stereotype the opposite direction, but at least it invites us to be challenged about the way we may generalize about those who are different. Back here in the room.
Can you just kind of fill me in? I was here yesterday, just like the context. So she's coming into the culture and he's Jewish, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So does she know the mores of the Jewish culture that he has to then take on the kinship?
She's evidently learned them all, yeah.
And where is she really coming from?
What is that?
Where has she really come from?
Moab. She's a Moabite, so they had in their first... Mm-hmm.
Like an unclean person?
Pretty much. I mean, about as enemy as they could get. They had originally gone into that enemy territory.
Okay.
You know, so she is kind of like... You know, in fact, one of the things that we talked about earlier is that the book is often believed to have been written at a point in which people were being told it was kind of like this fervor to purify the people, and people have been ordered to divorce their foreign wives because they're seen as better.
Descendant of David, and then through Jesus coming to that lineage, and then that sets us up for the outsider being on the inside.
Yeah, exactly. And you know how much so? There are only two women mentioned in Jesus' genealogy. Both of them are foreigners. Tamar is one, which you talked about yesterday, and Ruth. So, you know, those genealogies, they're not as boring as they seem.
Going back to the word worthy, we believe that each one of us worthy in the eyes of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Fearfully and wonderfully made, what is man that you are, all that kind of stuff. So worthy here is because of the secular things, or Boaz is trying to tell, hey, we are all worthy in the eyes of the Lord. So I should acknowledge that. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's there are two values to that word.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm
yeah.
Just what's your take on that?
That's an interesting. So that we are worthy because of who we have been made. We have been fearfully and wonderfully made, and he is recognizing her humanity. I mean, that's one powerful way to think about it. You know, which is part of what we struggle with in dealing with the other. Can we see ourselves in them? Can we see their humanity? Can we see that they are created in the image of God? So this is part of what he's doing here. Yeah. Appreciate that. All right. Let's go ahead and read a little bit more of the text. There's lots here that we, you know, can continue to think about. We won't exhaust the text in this round through. But and so as we start out, chapter 4, verse 1, and we'll read a little bit of that section in the time that we have left here, and we will be concluding this tomorrow. So we'll carry part of the text into tomorrow of that last chapter 4. So again, I think we have the same readers as before, except that the numbering dropped on this one, evidently, and putting this together, dropped the 1 and 2 on the narrator. So if you can just alternate narrator 1 and 2, that would be great. And then I think we need a next of kin. Anybody wants to be a next of kin? You only get like one line, two lines, sorry. Three. Oh, no, you get three lines. So lots of play. Need a next of kin.
Sure.
All right. Actually, for the sake of, you know, the play, let's go ahead and have a male do the next of kin. It's supposed to be a male. So let's have a male in it, just for the fun of it.
I can do it.
All right, great, thanks. All right, let's go ahead and try this.
No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin of whom Boaz had spoken came passing by. So Boaz said,
"Come over, friend. Sit down here."
Okay, 1 second. Sorry, we're going to reread that section, but I want to make sure that, because I am aware that some of us may not have been part of the conversation earlier on about the levirate marriage. Okay, so I'll say this briefly again as a reading. Part of what's in the background of the story that needs to be known as we go into it is that the next of kin is a technical term, the Hebrew word is goel, that the person who is to redeem somebody who has, you know, it's a legal term. And then what it says is, one of the expressions of it is, if a man and a woman are married, the man dies, then the next of kin, whoever the next relative is, it would be a brother, that would be if one is living, or, you know, then a cousin, and there's a pretty complicated system. The next of kin is responsible for that woman. And so would move in to marry, you know, would be responsible for marrying that person and then redeeming the individual, the land, and everything else, you know, and making sure that they are provided for. In our conversation earlier, you mentioned the importance of, you know, just the value of using the word redeem beyond just, okay, you've been redeemed from your sins, it's something you have done. But redeemer in the biblical text, this goel, is much broader than that. It is also not only saving us from bad things we've done, evil morality, but it is saving us from the forces that diminish our humanity, you know, from poverty, redeeming us from many other oppressive forces.
Uh-huh. Would the next of kin be the father?
No.
It would have to be like brother.
Exactly. It has to be. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, in the case of Tamar, it ends up being the father. Right. In part because he's unwilling to give his son. So he's forced to do it, but that's not normally the process. A little tense thing here, just as an aside, is that if Boaz could redeem Naomi, he could also have redeemed, I mean, Ruth, he could also have redeemed Naomi. Well, so I mean, that's always sort of a little hanging, you know, piece here that just throws a little extra complication into the story, right? All right, so let's kind of reread that section and then we continue on.
Should I start at the beginning?
Yeah.
No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin of whom Boaz had spoken came passing by. So Boaz said,
"Come over, friend. Sit down here."
And he went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said,
"Sit down here."
So they sat down. He then said to the next of kin,
"Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me so that I may know. For there is no one prior to you to redeem it, and I came after you." And I come after you.
And who was next for Kenigan Paul?
Redeem it.
All right.
The day you acquire the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also acquiring Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead man, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance.
At this, the next of kin said,
"I cannot redeem it for myself without damaging my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it."
Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz,
acquire it for yourself.
He took off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all of the people,
today you are witness that I have acquired the land of Naomi, all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Shilon and Malon. I have also acquired Ruth, the male,
the Moabite,
and wife of Malon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance, in order that the name of the dead may not be cut off from the kindred and from the gate of his native place. Today, you are witnesses.
We'll step there.
Then all the people...
Actually, we'll step there, sorry. And then we'll pick up tomorrow. But anything that stands out to you there, we've got just a couple of minutes over. What are some things that stand out to you there and that we will kind of continue
David,
to
would you tomorrow? Explain once again what the next of kin would lose by putting on...
First I'll point out just something really clever, right? That Boaz is like, well, you want to buy that land?
Yeah.
And the guy's, sure! Well, let's go to the wife. I'm like, yeah, not so much. What's at risk is that the first child to be born of the union of the redemption is not the biological father's child legally. It's actually the dead man's son. So it would split the inheritance. So he's paying and buying and redeeming this plot of land, but doesn't really get to keep it, because he's not going to see his own son, biological son, as his own, because now this will stay within the family, and it will protect then Naomi and Ruth and, you know, whoever else might make a claim on that part of the land.
So the genealogy of Jesus is wrong.
Oh,
doesn't it say Boaz and...
Yeah.
It should be Mount.
In many ways, yeah. I mean, the genealogies themselves of Jesus are they're crafted. They're not wrong. They're just very intentionally crafted. That's why you have to ask why certain things are done the way they are. Because the same thing, many people point out that discrepancy and say, oh, that's why Joseph, who's also listed in the genealogy, is listed as father. You know, it's the one who is willing to step in and do the role. You know, because there's a similar tension about Joseph with Jesus. Other things that stand out to you here before we...
Just that he names that she is a Moabite woman. And so that's going to cause problems in his own family if he takes on that.
Because
she is a stranger foreigner.
And what was mentioned before, how long will we remain a foreigner in the land? You know, this is used repeatedly. Moab, the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite from Moab. And it's like, yeah, got it. I understand.
I just noticed that the next of kin doesn't use the name of Mammon. It's what does he say? He says that the widow of the dead man.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't put a name or a face.
Yeah. Which is very interesting because the word in Hebrew for, you know, when that Boaz sees him out and says, hey, come over, friend, sit down here, you know, right at the beginning there on verse 1. The Hebrew word for friend that gets translated as friend is Palomi Almoni. I'm pronouncing that right. And it basically, in the Tanakh, is translated as you, so-and-so. It's actually translated as so-and-so because the guy has no face, no name. We don't know who he is because he is unwilling to live up to his commitment. He loses his own identity by his unwillingness to do that. Let me actually, we have lots of folks who haven't answered, but I do want to kind of say thanks to everybody. You're welcome to say, I'm glad to continue the conversation, but I do want to kind of give a chance to those who we need to kind of head out to other commitments to do so. But if you can, head out if you need to do so, but otherwise, let's continue with some of the conversations. I think there were two hands back here if you want to.